Page 200 of Saleka Sutta by Maharshi Sayadaw. Wrong intentions, Michha Sankapa. Other people may have wrong intentions, but we will have right intentions and thereby lessen our defilements. This is what the Pali text says. There are three kinds of wrong intentions, such as intentions arising from sensuous desires, that is, the intention to have the objects of one's desire, karma vitaka; intentions arising from ill will, or the intention to ruin another person, vyapada vitaka; and intentions arising from aggressive desire, or the intention to hurt another person, vihingsa vitaka. Nowadays, people harbour many wrong intentions, and the most common of these intentions is that which stems from sensuous desire. People usually are intent on getting the objects of their desire: good food, good clothes, good houses, cars, land, garden, cattle, and so forth. They have plans concerning their ambition, social relations, professions, families, maintenance of property, etc. In short, they are preoccupied with their sensuous desire almost the whole day. Of these intentions, the self-serving intention may be called right intention, but since it is based on unwholesome sensuous desire, it is termed wrong intention from the point of view of the Dharma. But the intention to seek lawfully the necessities of life is not greatly harmful. Even the bhikkhus who are devoted to the Dharma have to seek food, etc. And it is quite proper to think of doing lawfully what is unavoidable. However, during meditation, the yogi should not harbour such thoughts for a long time. They should be watched and rejected. What is gravely harmful is the intention to get unlawfully something which one does not deserve, or in the case of those who deserve it, obsession with the desire for it. For this kind of sensuous thought prolongs the cycle of life, samsara, even if it does not lead to the lower worlds. The best thing to do is to reject sensuous thought. The bhikkhus and yogis who have high regard for morality based on restraint of the senses should avoid sensuous thoughts about visabhaga objects, that is, objects in the form of males and females that have different physical appearances. Bhikkhus and male yogis should avoid thoughts about women and nuns, and female yogis should not think of men. Such sensuous thoughts impede concentration, knowledge, and mental development, and as such they are to be watched and rejected. Again, when we think of a person whom we hate, we tend to have ill will against him. We accuse him of having done something harmful to us, of having obstructed our plans, and so we long for his destruction and ruin. We're thinking of doing away with him. This is hateful thought arising from ill will, vyapada. The object of ill will is not necessarily a human being. When we seek to destroy snakes, scorpions, mosquitoes, bugs, etc., we are also motivated by ill will. We may justify our attempt to kill snakes, or tigers, etc., but the unwholesome karmic volition involved leads to suffering, and so every thought of killing for any reason or purpose is to be called a wrong intention. If the intention is not to kill a person, whom one hates, but only to ill-treat him. It is called vihingsa vitaka, or aggressive thought. Here one intends to beat, abuse, scold, or otherwise cause suffering to another person. If one is motivated by goodwill in his intention, there is no karmic result, but the aggressive thought that stems from hatred is karmically unwholesome, and the karmic result is grave in proportion to the moral purity of the person who is wronged. Right intention, samasankappa. Right intention is the opposite of wrong intention, and as such it is of three kinds, namely thought of renunciation, nekama vitaka, thought of hatelessness, avyapada vitaka, and thought of harmlessness, avihinksa vitaka. Of these three, the thought of renunciation is the intention to liberate oneself from sensuous desire, defilements, and the cycle of life. According to the commentary, joining the Buddhist Sangha is nekama, or renunciation. So is nibbana, or the first jhana, or vipassana, insight meditation, or the practice of charity, morality, etc. So the thought of entering the holy order, the thought of developing the mind to attain the first jhana, the thought of attaining nibbana, the thought of going to meditation center, the thought of observing the moral precepts, the thought of giving alms, the thought of hearing a sermon, each of these thoughts is thought of renunciation. Every thought of renunciation presupposes the right belief in karma. The belief is also involved at the time of translating the thought into action. So when you develop right intention or thought, you develop too right belief, and vice versa. Other parts of the path are also more or less developed accordingly. Thoughts of hatelessness is the opposite of thought of hatefulness. It is thought of the welfare of all living beings based on goodwill and love. Thought of harmlessness is the opposite of the thought of harmfulness. It is the thought arising from compassion and sympathy. People usually have regard only for those who are associated with them. They tend to ill-treat any person who opposes them. In this world of such moral degradation, it is indeed very noble to think of the welfare of all living beings, universally, with love and compassion. Here we will cite the story of a bodhisattva, Sumedha's, thought of renunciation that is so memorable. Bodhisattva Sumedha was born eons ago. His parents died when he was young. So the treasurer of the family handed over to the young man all the wealth that had been accumulated by the seven generations of his forefathers. Sumedha reflected on the mortality of his forefathers, who had left all their wealth in the hands of other people. They could not come and look after their property. They could not use any of their former property, nor could they take it away with them. Now Sumedha hoped to take away his wealth in the form of karmic effect by giving it away. In other words, he hoped to gain merit by almsgiving, the merit that is called anugamika property, because it is the property that always follows the donor in the cycle of life. There are four kinds of property: jangama property, tavara property, angasama property, and anugamika property. The commentary describes slaves, cattle, and other living things as jangama property, and the non-moving, lifeless things as tavara property. But we will classify property in the traditional way, gold, silver, and clothing, etc., which are easily changeable, are to be regarded as jangama property. This kind of property is not durable. Although it is one's property, it is another person's possession. When it gets into the hands of a thief, a robber, or a swindler, for example, a fountain pen or a pocket watch that is stolen by a pickpocket, becomes his property and it is hard to recover it unless it bears identification marks or there is someone to testify to your ownership. So you cannot own a thing permanently if it can change hands easily. It may be yours now, but it may belong to another the next moment. So gold, silver, etc., which are not of immediate use to us, have to be changed into permanent property, such as land, building, etc. A permanent property cannot be moved secretly, and so is more durable than movable property. Yet you may lose it when a powerful man legally claims it by right of inheritance. Or you may lose it because you cannot always count on it through the change of times. You cannot always count on it, and so it is better to change it into angasama property, or property like the parts of your body. You carry this property wherever you go, just like your legs or hands. This kind of property is a person's occupation, like painting, like teaching, like writing, like dancing, like medicine, like law, and so forth. A man can earn his living by his profession. He cannot be robbed of it, and so people spend money on the education of their children. But a vocational training or knowledge may be of no use if the law forbids its practice. So more solid than the property of profession is the anugami property in the form of almsgiving, morality, etc. Nobody can steal it or rob you of it or prevent it from producing its wholesome karmic effect. It will follow you in your life cycle and prove beneficial. So Sumedha thought of turning his wealth into the most solid property, or anugami property, that he could take with him on his death. So the Bodhisattva Sumedha gave away all his wealth and became an ascetic. He was then about 16, or at most 20 years old. As a young ascetic, he developed concentration, trained his mind, and within 7 days, he attained jhana and psychic power. Later on, he offered himself as a bridge at the foot of the Dipti-pankara Buddha, who prophesied that he would become a Buddha. Here, the Bodhisattva's intention to give away all his wealth as the right intention, or the thought of renunciation. So was his thought of becoming an ascetic and trying to attain jhana and psychic powers. So too was his thought of seeking Buddhahood by offering his body to be used as a bridge by the Buddha. Likewise, the thought of making daily devotion before the shrine of the Buddha and observing the 5 precepts, etc., is thought of renunciation. So is the thought of observing the 8 precepts on the Upasaka days, or the thought of hearing the Dhamma and practicing it. Here, the practice of the Dhamma means renunciation of desirable and pleasant sense objects. The Dhamma will be foreign to those who are steeped in sensuous pleasure. So although you urge them to practice it, they will refuse to do so on one pretext or another. You have thoughts of hatelessness, of avyapada, when you diffuse love and goodwill towards a person or persons, or when you are interested in their welfare, or when you work for their welfare verbally or physically, or when as a leader you do something for the good of your followers. You have thoughts of harmlessness, avihingsa vitaka. When you avoid harming a person out of compassion and sympathy, or when you think of saving or helping a suffering person, such compassionate thoughts occur often in nurses and doctors who attend the sick kind-heartedly. It is with compassion and thoughts of harmlessness that we pray for the end of suffering among other people. So let us cultivate compassion especially towards those who are sick, distressed, or wailing over their misfortunes. During the practice of insight meditation, every moment of mindfulness means the rejection of three kinds of unwholesome thought and the cultivation of the three kinds of wholesome thought. If at the moment of seeing, the visual object is watched and its true nature, that is the fact of its having the three marks of anicca, dukkha and anatta, realized, there can be no sensuous thought, no hateful thought and no harmful thought. The same may be said of the state of consciousness at the moment of hearing or eating, etc. Every moment of mindfulness means the development of wholesome thoughts as opposed to unwholesome thoughts. In other words, the right intention in itself that is involved in mindfulness helps to develop thoughts of renunciation, thereby excluding sensuous thoughts. Ill will and aggressive thoughts are removed in the same way. For if you are aware of the impermanence of everything at every moment of mindfulness, how can there be the desire for an impermanent object or malicious and aggressive thoughts on account of it? So the meditating yogis develop the three kinds of thought or intention at every moment of mindfulness as their insight knowledge develops and becomes perfect. They see nibbana and attain the Aryan path. The right intention on the Aryan level helps the yogi to overcome the unwholesome thoughts progressively. At the first stage, it removes the sensuous thoughts that lead to the lower worlds. At the second stage, it removes the gross forms of sensuous thoughts, etc. At the third stage, the subtle forms of sensuous thoughts are stamped out, while at the last stage, i.e. on the level of the Arahat, the right intentions root out the unwholesome thoughts arising from the desire for the world of forms and the formless world. The Buddha therefore urged his disciples to lessen their defilements by having right intentions. We should cultivate right intentions to avoid the wrong path of wrong intentions for our spiritual uplift and for the extinction of wrong intentions. Wrong speech, micha vacha, wrong speech is speaking wrongly or improperly. It is of four kinds, such as lying, slandering in order to create dissension among those who love one another, abusing, and talking frivolously. These kinds of speech may serve the interest of the speaker, and so there may be justification for them in their own eyes, but they may be harmful to other persons, and the speaker will have to bear the unwholesome karmic effect of his wrong speech in future. Right speech, sama vacha. Right speech means abstinence from wrong speech. Here the term sama vacha refers not to what one says, but to the avoidance of lying, etc. Whenever the occasion arises, such abstention is called virati. Those who are committed to the five precepts should avoid lying and kindred wrong speech such as slandering, abusing, and frivolous talk. Needless to say, the abstention from the four kinds of wrong speech is binding on those who have committed themselves to ajivata maka morality. During meditation, the abstention is effected through overcoming by the opposite Tadanga Pahana. So in effect, meditation involves virati, abstention, although it has substantially little to do with it. Then, on the Aryan path, the four kinds of wrong speech are rooted out through destruction, samucheda pahana. Wrong speech, micha kamanta. Wrong action is of three kinds, namely killing, stealing, and committing sexual acts wrongfully. These acts may be justified by those who commit them, but they are by no means justifiable from the point of view of the victim. For how can you say that it is proper for a person to kill you for the good of someone or some people, to steal or rob you of your property, or to lust for your wife or daughter? Everyone will agree that these acts are evil, and those who commit them will have to suffer in future for their evil deeds. Here too, right action means abstinence from killing, etc. Those who have committed themselves to non-killing and so avoid killing are doing the right action. Every moment of mindfulness during meditation leads to abstinence from killing, etc. Although it involves no element of consciousness, chaitasika, as regards abstention, virati. On the Aryan path, all wrong actions are done away with through destruction. Wrong livelihood, micha ajiva. Wrong livelihood is to earn one's living by getting money unlawfully. Some people commit evil deeds, such as killing, to make their living, but some commit evil not for economic reason, but because of their greed or anger. Evil deeds that have nothing to do with one's living, but stem from anger or greed, are not wrong livelihood, but wrong action or wrong speech. For example, the killing of mosquitoes and snakes, etc., for one's enemy, or one's enemy through anger, is wrong action. But the killing of chickens, pigs, fish, etc. for the market or for one's own consumption is wrong livelihood. As for stealing or robbing, it is usually done for economic reason, and so most of these acts are to be classified as wrong livelihood. Stealing out of spite or through ill will, habit or propensity is of course wrong action. Unlawful sexual intercourse has usually nothing to do with one's living. To seduce a woman, however, for the sake of money or for one's living is wrong livelihood. Telling a lie in business transaction is wrong livelihood. If you lie for other reasons, it is wrong speech. The same may be said of slandering. Nowadays, some kinds of propaganda are defamations that fall within the category of wrong livelihood. They are very harmful. Abusive language is not very much used in business. But there are many kinds of wrong livelihood in the form of frivolous talk that we can find in fiction writing, play acting, filmmaking, and so forth. All kinds of wrong livelihood involve violation of the moral code that prescribes abstinence from killing, etc. Those who observe five precepts are free from the seven kinds of wrong livelihood that we have mentioned above. It is obvious that those who adhere to ajivata marka morality are especially free from wrong livelihood. Right livelihood is to earn money lawfully with moral life, untainted by any kind of wrong livelihood. Right livelihood, sama ajiva, To put it another way, right livelihood is to make one's living without killing, stealing, etc. Wise men of yore described it as proper farming, proper trading, and so forth. Obviously, proper farming is cultivating crops, or gardening by one's sweat of labour, without ill-treating another person. Proper trading is to buy goods at proper price without ill-treating, killing, stealing, robbing, or cheating another person, and then to sell them property at current prices. In olden days, there were few traders who made a profit of one kayat on a commodity that was worth 10 kayats. Later, the businessmen became greedy and some of them sold their goods at a profit of 100%. And this is not proper marketing. Proper marketing is to market goods of genuine quality at proper prices without any attempt at profiteering. Thus, those who thus sell their goods properly benefit from their business. In 1952, there was in Zagyo Bazaar at Mandalay a grocery owner named Ko Nyan. He was a Burmese Buddhist. He spoke to his customers courteously. "Sir, what can I do for you?" He did not overcharge his goods, but stated the exact price. If a customer haggled, he would say, "Sir, I cannot reduce the price. I make only a profit of 2 piche on 1 kyat. Even if the buyer happened to be a child, he never thought of cheating over the price and quality of the goods. If the wrong article was sold by mistake, the buyer could change it for the right one. So his 4 or 5 assistants were always busy, a form of right livelihood that was really commendable. Again, a government worker, a government employee, or a worker in a private business, or a porter who does his work dutifully for a reasonable wage, is earning right livelihood. So is the driver or the boatman who works conscientiously and charges fairly for his service. The right livelihood and the wrong livelihood of the bhikkhus. Unlike the laymen, with their 7 rules of conduct, the bhikkhus have a wide variety of moral rules binding on them. A bhikkhu should not ask for food, robes, or dwelling unless the person who is thus requested happens to be his relative or to have invited him. Neither should he nor other bhikkhus use anything that is received in this way. Asking outright for donations, as is being done nowadays, is very unbecoming of a bhikkhu. A bhikkhu should not even show signs or make indirect remarks that would induce a layman to offer food or robes. It is wrong livelihood to use anything that the bhikkhu obtains by begging or showing signs or through artful suggestions. Moreover, any effort on the part of a bhikkhu to make himself intimate with laymen or lay women, or to endear himself to them by giving flowers, endear himself to them by giving fruits or food, is an offence called kula dusana, which means destroying the faith of the laity. Giving flowers, etc., may help to win the affection of the recipients, but it will not contribute to their faith. For respect for a bhikkhu can become genuine faith only if it is due to his moral purity and other qualities. So any attempt to cultivate intimacy by giving flowers, etc., is harmful to the original true faith that the bhikkhu's virtuous life has created. The lay follower is then likely to revere only the monk who gives flowers. He will not care for other good monks. The so-called reverence for the liberal monk is in reality nothing more than affection that we can find among ordinary people, since it has little to do with faith. So it is improper for a bhikkhu to offer flowers and food, etc., to his lay followers, to fawn on them, to serve them, to care for their children, to practice medicine, to read their horoscopes, or engage in any other faith-destroying wrong livelihood. It is also wrong livelihood to make use of the consumer goods which the monk gets by means of such practices. The bhikkhus should avoid, too, hypocrisy in regard to material goods, jhana, magga, etc., and the practice of meditation. Some bhikkhus pretend to have no desire for the robe or food offered by their lay followers. They would refuse to accept it, saying, "I do not want good robes or good food. I am content with cast-off rags and the food that I get by begging." Their refusal strengthens the faith of their lay follower, who repeatedly requests them to accept his offer. Then they accept, and never decline the offer of the lay believers, on whom they have thus impressed their apparent distaste for the good things of life. This is the way of earning one's living wrongly by posing as an ascetic. A monk may say, "A bhikkhu who wears his robes like this or dwells in such a place is usually a noble one, an arahat, or one who has attained jhana and psychic powers." The description conforms to the speaker's mode of life, the way he puts on his robe. This is a kind of wrong livelihood by a hypocritical monk. Some monks do not meditate, but they behave themselves quietly and gently like a meditating yogi. They stand, sit, lie down, bend or stretch their hands, like a yogi absorbed in jhana or concentration. This is also wrong livelihood by false pretense. Some pretend to be able to read the mind of another person. If a monk who is preaching says, "Oh, the woman over there is distracted. Be attentive and practice breathing." There may be indeed be some distracted woman in the congregation. Such women would be much impressed and have a high opinion of the monk. Or if a monk says that he was a king and that such and such a woman was his queen in a previous existence, he will be credited with psychic powers by some of his followers. This is wrong livelihood by deception. A bhikkhu should not use anything that is offered by a lay disciple who has been thus deceived. He should live only on those things that he can have by right livelihood. If there is no one to offer him food, he should go about begging for it. If he has no proper robe, he should search for cast-off rags. Or he should stand in front of the house of a layman, and when he is asked what he wants, he should express his desire for a robe. It is not improper to say what he wants in response to an inquiry. To seek the necessities of life through bodily expression, kaya vinyati, is right livelihood. Food, robes, etc., which a layman offers out of regard for the learning, spiritual life, and sermons of a monk, are pure since the monk receives them lawfully. So the Buddha urged his disciples to make their living rightfully.